there was a, called the 618T was basically a takeoff on the version of the KWM-2 that was very popular. That was called the 618, but a lot of those 6 series, the 615, the 618s, I think were all basically produced for the Air Force. What happened was, like with the 618, you know, that 6 is the HF transmitter that was used on the 747. Did you know that, Dick? Over.
For Air Force One, maybe? I know there was a version of, well, I think with the Collins receiver, where you were turning dials on the front panel to phase lock each one of the individual local oscillators for each one of the mixing functions, depending on what frequency you are listening to. Maybe that's not the same one, but go ahead with some further description on this one, Joe, if you want to.
Yeah, this what I'm looking at here is digital. Wait a minute. It's all digital. There's a big digital tuning knob. And it's definitely 651S-1. And all huge digital red display.
Okay. That may be a somewhat rare one. So once again, 0.5, 2.1, 5, and 8 kilohertz Collins filters. The 8, I'm guessing, is AM reception. Was the 5 usable on sideband, Mel? One of the things I complain about is that, yes, when you're on a crowded 20-meter band on Sunday afternoon, you probably want a 1.8 KC filter to try to slice your particular desirable signal in there. But if you're really holding a rag shoe with a guy, I'd like to have a 4 or a 5 kilohertz filter, because sideband is capable of some nice high fidelity if you have a broad enough filter. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, no, I got a quickie question for you there.
Okay, quickie.
Thank you, sir. What year did Collins cash it in? Because what I'm trying to think of is, when I was in the Army, that was in like 65, 66, 67, I ran into a ton of Collins equipment, all transistorized. Now, you tell me that was already Rockwell at that time?
Yeah, any of the solid state was already done on the Rockwell contracting. Collins gave up. He didn't want to know about transistors. That's it. His engineers, that's one of the words he said, you know, you guys are great when it comes to designing vacuum tube circuits, but none of them there, actually. You know, you talk to people, and all day I saw the same thing happen other places too. They actually was like wanted to go on producing the boat anchors, vacuum tube boat anchors, when already that everything else was becoming solid state. Barry, over.
W2C,
okay. Okay, so you're saying that all the aircraft stuff and everything, that was all Rockwell. Collins really wasn't doing that anymore.
That's what he's saying. Bill, the B2C UK, straighten us out on this one, Bill. I bet you own some of these.
Negative on owning, but I was in the Air Force between 68 and 72. And I think about 1971, I took a course on Collins and Airborne, that ARC prefix. I, for the life of me, can't remember the name of the radio, but everyone was fascinated. It was the first Varactor-tuned radio to be used in an airplane. And I don't remember if it was used in the F-111 or what, for an older plane, but one of the first Varactor-tuned radios, I took a course on it. But you have to realize, Dick, that most of the equipment I worked on was tubes, and the control boxes used dip switches to a little rack of dip switches to set the frequency. Really antique stuff. But that was in the 70s, so I guess I'm pretty sure it was Collins, and I'm pretty sure it was still around then. Back to you, Dick.
You got it, Mel.
Yeah, Rod, well, that's what it was. I can say the later stuff, when it started being the solid state, that's really when Rockwell Collins was in collaboration. Bit by bit, you know, Rockwell did not take over Collins all in one shot. They sort of ate it up piece by piece. He was losing control. It seems, if you read the way Arthur Collins put it, it's like I was watching the front door and they were coming in the back door. You know, that's it. He's guarding the front door, but they snuck in the back door because they got control of the company. Because I could say, if you read between the lines, it was mismanagement, part antique type management in this world. You know, it just unfortunately was a bad takeover. The way it sounded like, it was a lot of you actually walked away, if you want to look at it, with his tail between his legs. Dick, over.
Yeah, that is sad, because that was an awful lot of capability there. I think you should go to the next, at least one more mailbag response, Mel, go ahead.
Roger, like I say, Arthur Collins came away with not much money. I don't think he came away with very much at all, considering the company that he controlled and what it had produced and all. He did not become the so-called CEO of a mega company, you know, and with the salary that you'd expect. So it was sad in a way. Some people say he deserved it, but it was sad in a way. It's too bad. Like I say, it was a very good, viable company. Did a lot of research, did a lot of engineering that brought us a lot of the products we have today, and it's a shame. I really sorry that was a great American company that produced the number one pieces of communication equipment in this world. And sorry that we fell behind like that. All right, enough of that. We can go on all night just about Collins. Let me see what we've got here. I'll try to read over some more here and stuff that we could possibly answer. Hang on, let me read down the line. There's a lot of stuff here I'm not going to tackle because we've sort of gone over it and I can't really answer it. Anymore, because you can go to amateurradio.tv and see the different tutelages that we've done on this and all. I have here, I bought a, I've had antenna problems, so there. Here we go again. I notice on my antenna tuner, which is a manual antenna tuner, that I get false match points occasionally. I think it's false match point because a lot of times I put my hand on top of the tuner and it's hot. Can you tell me what is going on here? Yep. Okay, Dick, do you want to take that?
All right. I don't own an automatic antenna tuner, but I know that they will sometimes go into a hang-up mode. A well-designed antenna tuner looks at the reflected signal, measures its magnitude and its phase angle. And once you've got that information, reflected signal, magnitude and phase angle, if the system is well designed, it's a little bit like a blind man walking up a hill. That blind man, the sight impaired person, can feel by the tilt of his feet which way is uphill. He knows which way to go to get to the top of the hill. And an automatic antenna tuner should be able to do that. Well, there are certain frequencies where the phase detector doesn't give the right answer, the amplitude detector doesn't give the right answer, and the thing goes into a hang-up mode. So there are some automatic antenna tuners that do not automatically always arrive at the right answer. You have to help it out. There are some that I've heard about where you pre-tune it into the right area, and then it finds home plate. But there are some times when the antenna tuner gets stuck in the parking lot. It doesn't find home plate. It doesn't get into the ballpark. It doesn't get into the ballpark. So, and you can find that out fairly fast by, most of them will have a method by which you can flip the knobs on the front panel and measure what standing wave ratio is the transmitter seeing. When the thing arrives at home plate, I think the transmitter should see something like 1.2 or better. And if it doesn't, quite possibly it found I got into a hang-up mode. Second of all, in some cases, when you've got a full PI network or PI-L network, there's more than one way you can set the inductor, capacitor, and whatever in order to arrive at a good tuning. However, some of the ways of setting it run at much higher efficiency than other ways. you could end up with, for instance, using too little inductor and a whole lot of capacitor. You end up with a whole lot of circulating current, and the thing becomes a little bit wasteful. Well, the cabinet becoming hot, that could happen if you're doing pretty long transmitting and wasting 10 watts. The cabinet could become quite hot. And 10 watts out of, say, for instance, a 500-watt rig, that's still some pretty darn good efficiency. But in some of them, there's more than one way of tuning. I wonder what you've seen along these lines, Bill. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. This is a manual tuner, and I know exactly what you're talking about when you start trying to match different types of really complex loads. You're trying to, you know, accommodate sometimes a wide repeat, you know, differential between the input and the output, basically. So under fault condition, and what will happen is the output load is such that the power, a tremendous amount of the power, can be absorbed by the tuner itself. So it may look like a favorable match sometimes to the transmitter, but the components inside the tuner are absorbing a lot of power. One of the ways that, can be suggested that when especially have the manual tuners, and some of them, the older manual tuners used to suggest what you would do is use a field strength meter. They used to even suggest using a remote field strength meter that you would put out at a distance and look at it with a pair of binoculars, or you can make one that's remote reading with a pickup unit, and then a pair of wires coming into the shaft with a meter, usually a sensitive meter that used to tell you to use something like a 0 to 50 microamp meter, and adjust it then to the point where you'll see, like you say, several different points. You don't know which one is the fault point. Find the one that gives you the maximum reading on the field strength meter. That'll be the correct adjustment of that tuner. That's the way a number of the old timers and some of the older magazines they suggest to go over.
Yeah, that's a brute force approach. However, if you have an accurate voltmeter representing what is going down the center of the coax cable, when you get the maximum efficiency of your antenna tuner, without a doubt you have maximized the voltage going into that coax cable. As such, as long as you're not being fooled in frequency. Now, in the early days, there were transmitters that put out a significant amount of second harmonic and third harmonic, and therefore you could really be fooled. But modern day transmitters that follow the FCC rules, where all the second and third harmonics are 60 decibels down, in theory, only one frequency is coming out of the rig. When one frequency comes out of the rig, and you've got some kind of a simple resistor divider, capacitor, filter network, I mean a crystal diode detector, measuring the real voltage going into your cable, you maximize that voltage going into your cable, you have maximized the output, you've maximized the efficiency of the antenna tuner. So measuring what goes into the cable has got to be the same as measuring what's coming out of the cable. And that's what you're doing with that field strength meter and the binoculars. It's a good way to do that as a check, but you shouldn't have to do that on a day-to-day basis, in my opinion. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, Roger, once you get the the operation, you mark down the markings on the dial, and you can use them anytime you use that antenna. Proper tuner, Dick just said, proper tuner adjustment would be basically, if you're going to use this field strength method, proper tuner adjustment would be indicated by minimum SWR and at the same time maximum field strength reading. I think that's the simplest way to put it, Dick. Over.
Yeah, but maximum field strength reading really is maximum radiation from the antenna. That can only occur when you've maximized the voltage into the transmission line. So unless you've got harmonics going on that are confusing you, maximum voltage going into the transmission line at the shack has to be the exact same point as maximum radiation from the antenna on the far end of the transmission line. That's my belief, sir. Mel, go ahead.
Roger, and you'll see minimum SWR on the meter on the tuner, over.
Yes and no. Some solid-state transmitters will produce maximum power output when they see a slight amount of mismatch. I could easily have a transistorized transmitter that, because it doesn't have any internal tuning controls, produces maximum power output when it sees a 1.4 visuar of a particular phase angle. That may not be the point of maximum linearity and the purest sounding signal for single sideband, but when it comes to key down maximum power output for Morse code, a specific amount of mismatch, a small amount of mismatch of the right phase angle may maximize the power output. So lowest visuar on that particular rig may not be max power output. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, we get this several ways. Dick just says a false match will result in a very weak field reading, basically. So I guess I could say a number of ways to go. I'm just giving the old-fashioned way that they used to suggest with homebrewing tuners and getting it set up. Dick. All right, I think we ought to cover that. You want to try another one?
Go for it.
Reading over some of them here and see if I can, what I can read. On the air. All right. What is this one here? No, I better not tackle that. Please no. Okay, here's a question. Why are my linear amplifiers, do they say, tune quickly and do it at a low level? Okay, that's a good question. Dick, you want to take it first?
Yeah. When you have a rig set up for best single sideband service, I'll give an example of numbers that I think are close to right. A 6146 tube, a popular tube way back in the dark ages, has 25 watts of plate dissipation. A popular rig in the old days would have a pair of 6146 tubes running in parallel. You got a total of 50 watts of plate dissipation. Linear service, the amplifier maybe is running on average with speech 35% efficiency. So therefore, when a rig is capable of 120 watts of output, peak envelope power, if you try to run 120 watts peak envelope power at 35 or so percent efficiency, you'd be asking for the tubes to dissipate 70 watts. Well, a pair of tubes, 25 watts each, can only dissipate 50 watts, in my example. Therefore, if you ran that rig key down, and you did it for 2 solid minutes, there's a moderately good possibility you're going to overheat those plates, which in turn overheat the cathode and slightly damage the cathode and hurt the emission of the tube. The plate, it's got a thermal time constant of, I'm going to pick a number, 20 seconds. So if you hold down the key for 20 seconds at a time while you rapidly do the tuning, let up on the key for 20 seconds, let the tube cool off a little bit, and go back into your tuning, and you do that in sessions like that, you can keep from damaging those tubes. Whereas on the normal single sideband service, if you whistled continuously into the microphone, it would be the equivalent of key down, but almost nobody ever does that. A continuous tone with no interruption whistled in the mic. Normal human speech has a 23 dB crust factor. That means the peaks of my speech are 23 dB louder than the average of my speech, because there's pauses in between there, and if you actually look at an oscilloscope of human speech, it's far from the sine wave. It's a very complicated waveform. So a rig adjusted for maximum power output by short tuning cycles could be set up in such a way that it gives the cleanest peak envelope power on single sideband and is perfectly happy when you talk continuously, but don't do it that way with a high power output key down for more than, I'm going to pick a number, 20 seconds. You might damage your tube. On top of that, the power supply maybe is not made to deliver that current continuously, depending on how robust is that particular design. K2KE1, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KY. Yep, basically that's what Dick said. If you took in the old days, a pair of 6146s, and they ran up to say about 100 watts. Now, if we used it on, now those 6146s, basically, when they came along, was not sideband, were not used on single sideband. They mostly were used in the transmitters of the 50s that were AM transmitters. So if you took a rig that they used to call it a 100-watt rig, such as Johnson Viking 2, Heath Kit DX100, and all those radios and all, they jumped on the 6146 with tubes that previous tubes that were able to make more compact rigs, and it was an excellent tube. So if the amplifier, for instance, if it was rated at, say, 100 watts, assume if you put a single tone sinusoidal modulation and modulated, say, to 100%, since the, as the, what we call the carrier amplitude doubles a modulation peak with amplitude modulation. So the power on a peak actually went to, on AM, four times the carrier value. So that an amplifier running in this kind of class, PEP rating, you would be looking at about 400 watts. So basically, I guess that's the best way to explain it, Dick, over.
Yeah, the AM situation is even more severe. Pure high-fidelity amplitude modulation, like Mel said. You have a certain amount of carrier power, and the peak envelope power is four times that amount of power. The rig is requested to double the voltage output during the peak envelope power of double sideband amplitude modulation. Single sideband is not quite that severe, but still, the alignment of the rig, if you really are a purist, you do a two-tone alignment or a trapezoidal alignment as a way of setting up oscilloscopes and spectrum analyzers, such that while the tones are going in, you're adjusting the tuning and loading controls until you get the least amount of intermodulation distortion and nearly the maximum power output with an acceptable amount of intermodulation distortion. So a two-tone test, two audio tones going into the microphone, is the ideal way with the right instrumentation to set up a rig. The not-so-ideal way, but almost good enough, is in the TW mode, key down briefly, adjust for maximum power output. It does a very good job. Not absolutely the best, but pretty darn close. Gets you into the ballpark, gets you pretty close to home plate. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger. Very good. This is K2KEY. Basically, what he, basically, like he hit upon, he says, so the average power with 100% modulation was put into these pair of tubes, there will be approximately 150 watts. What this means that 50 watts will be supplied for the side frequency, and if the amplifier stage was usually somewhere around 50% efficient, that means there will be 75 watts of power dissipated in the final amplifier for 100% modulated signal. So if you were running these pair of tubes and running them in PEP, peak envelope power, the it would have to go to approximately 400 watts of dissipation. So you can well imagine how hot these tubes will get very quickly in this situation. I think that's more of the sales analogy. Am I correct, Dick? Over.
Yeah, I think your numbers are a little bit higher, but you still got the point across. So the alignment procedure can easily exceed the plate dissipation of the tubes. Therefore, the manual recommends you do it briefly. If you're a purist, you can do it with two tones. If you're a Morse code enthusiast, you can set an automatic here to transmit a continuous set of dots, because the dots have a certain 50% or so duty factor. Now it's a very safe way. You adjust the maximum power output while your automatic keyer is automatically continuously sending dots. That's a very safe way of lining the rig for best condition. I've seen guys do that with many a rig. Where this turns into something that's ridiculous is in a field effect transistor rig or in a traveling wave tube rig, everything is backwards. By that I mean a traveling wave tube dissipates the maximum power when you ask for nothing output. If you've got a tube that's capable of dissipating, of giving you 100 watts of output, a traveling wave tube capable of giving you 100 watts of output, when you ask the tube that you're, to give you 100 watts of output, the collector, the beam has a certain amount of power capability. The beam is roaring down the center of the tube, and the power that you don't suck out of the beam, the energy that you don't suck out of that beam, has to go into the collector assembly. So in my ridiculous example, I got a tube with 100-watt capability, and it runs at, I'm going to pick a number, 25% efficiency. So therefore, the beam has the ability to generate five times. The beam has the ability to generate 500 watts, and you're getting 100 watts out of it, 20% efficiency. Therefore, when you're getting 100 watts out, 400 watts is being dissipated by the beam collector assembly. When you don't ask for the 100 watts of output, if you ask for 0 watts of output, it's the exact same beam running down that tube. You're not sucking out any of its energy. Now the collector assembly must dissipate 500 watts, not 400 watts. So the traveling wave tube runs hottest when you don't ask for power output. You'd be amazed how many microwave hams get that backwards. They're afraid to run key down when they're aligning the rig. They don't realize that as far as the total tube is concerned, the tube will run cooler when you ask for maximum power output. There's a slight variation of that. Now, if you've got a high standing wave ratio, you could be roaring some power back into the tube, and now you could be overheating the helix. That's what's really developing the dollar for you. So it's complicated. But in the case of field effect transistor type linear amplifiers and traveling wave tubes, you could easily get it backwards, and the tuning should take your own three times. But that's a rare case. Not many of us run into that one. But most of the rigs that we run try to keep the tuning brief, or in many rigs they've got a so-called tune mode where they either lower the seed voltage or they do something to lower the dissipation of the tube while you're doing the alignment. K2KE1, K2LIW, go to another one if you want to, Mel.
Right. Yes, that's exactly how I was going to put it, a little different, but I'll make it very simple and finish this off. The ratio, as Dick was trying to explain, the ratio of PEP rating, the PEP rating to the average dissipation is usually in the range of sometimes 6 to 8 to 1. So that is why, this is the reason why in many single sideband transmitters, they will say tune quickly or tune up at a lower level. I think that's the easiest way to say it, Dick. Over.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a problem with the tuning of lower level. It gets you very close to the home plate, but not exactly. Because when you lower the screen voltage or lower the drive level, the way you adjust the tuning and loading may not give the highest linearity for single sideband. Only a two-tone test would really do that. But very few of us have got a spectrum analyzer capable of analyzing the output components of a two-tone test. If a rig is really running max power output, and if it's loaded and tuned just right, you plug in two tones, and very little output comes out of that rig except those two tones. You put in two audio tones, and out comes two tones on single sideband RF. And as you adjust the rig poorly, lightly loaded so that it starts flat-topping, you'll notice that you put in two tones and you get out four tones. The other two tones are called third-order intermodulation distortion. But it takes a spectrum analyzer to resolve that. Not many of us have got that. So just know that a two-tone test is ideal. You can do it with your own sweet time, because now it would be just a little bit higher in duty factor than human speech. But a pure tone, a single sideband transmitter, when you run a key down for tuning, what the Morse code key is doing for you is putting in one single tone. One single tone, believe it or not, is much higher duty factor than two tones. When you got two tones at two slightly different frequencies, they spend a certain amount of their time co-phase, a certain amount of their time antiphase, where they cancel, a certain amount of time in quadrature, where you're only asking for 70% of the power output, or something like 71.71% power output. So two tones is a much more conservative test, but a very good way of tuning than a single tone. Hard to believe that one tone is tough on a sideband amplifier and two tones are easy when it's working right. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, fine business. Okay. I say that's why they do say on a number of, as I said, on single sideband transmitters, to tune quickly on the ones that had manual tuning, which you won't find anymore, but the earlier versions, that's why they said tune quickly. Or they used to have a tune position, which actually tuned at a lower level, but then what you did, you basically got it tweaked to where approximately it is at the lower level, then you flip the switch up Collins rigs. That's what I have on my Collins rigs. I have 9 Collins rigs, and they all seem to have that same setup of tune, the switch that says tune. When you go to that tune position, as you see, the power level is down, and you just touch it up to get the drive and loading and DA and loading and all and set it up, and then you go to the regular, you put the switch up, and then you just touch it up a little bit. But they tell you to do it quickly so that you don't overheat the tubes. All right, I guess that's it. You want to try another one, Dick? Over.
Yeah, but I want you to run something by again. Very rapidly, very quickly, you said something. And my ears caught this one, Mel. Did you say you own 9 Collins rigs?
Yeah, right now I have 9. Yes, I do have 9 Collins rigs right now. Let's see, I got 75A4, KWS1, 30S1, 30L1, 75F3, 32S3. Yeah, I got about, I got KWM2. Yes, I got 9 Collins rigs right now, then.
Wow, I'm impressed. You are an enthusiast. My goodness, you have brand loyalty. How many human beings on planet Earth do you think own 9 Collins rigs?
About my friend that owns 50.
He's crazy. You're enthusiastic.
Well, you want to see a count. I'll tell you what. You know how K6DTZ. Have you ever been to his shack, Dick?
No, but now I want to be. Go ahead.
Okay, take a look at him online. Just take a look. He deals in this sort of a business with him, but I bet he's got 200 of them, maybe more. I talked to guys, 50, 75 from Collins rigs. You have no idea. I'm just a beginner. I'm not a collector. They're all working with these equipment. But I got friends that they collected everything that Collins ever made. So you can't imagine. My friend George, Pennsylvania, he's got at least 15 right now. I don't know how many more he's had, but he had duplicates, triplicates of certain ones. Yeah, but we're Collins people. We're very, very loyal to them. All right, let me pick another one. Hold on. I'm looking. Okay. Here's another antenna question. I'm using a 60-foot random length NZ wire for my antenna. On 80 meters, I have no problem. Okay. But on 40 and 20 and 15, I have lots of RF around the shack. I've tried the transmatch, and everything seems up okay. But I'm always getting bit by RF. I have a fairly good earth ground. I cannot lengthen the antenna nor do anything more with the antenna. And grounded it to the transmatch. What should I do? Okay, you take it.
Alrighty. Classic problem of an unbalanced antenna. And the best way I got at explaining this is the Arnold Schwarzenegger story you guys have heard so often. Maybe this person hasn't heard it. Picture Arnold Schwarzenegger in the space shuttle in orbit, floating free in space. Assume he weighs 200 pounds, and assume he's got a 200-pound barbell in his hand, and he's floating in the cargo hold. He pushes the barbell at 1 foot per second to the north. By Newton's third law, action and reaction, he moves 1 foot per second to the south. That's physics. It'll happen every time. Action and reaction. Okay. Now let me have a completely symmetrical dipole antenna set with twin lead cable. Assume my dipole is in free space, half-wave long electronically. It's got a 72-ohm input impedance, and I'm feeding it with 72-ohm twin lead cable. And I'm feeding a 2-volt sine wave into the... I'm going to feed a 72-volt sine wave into the twin lead. By definition, 72-volt volts on a 72-ohm line means 1 ampere AC is flowing into that twin lead, and 72 volts is flowing into it. I walk down that twin lead, and I start studying microscopically what's happening at the center of the dipole. I'm launching 72 volts. 36 volts goes to the right. At the instant the voltage is positive, 36 volts goes to the right, 36 negative volts goes to the left, 1 ampere goes to the right, negative 1 ampere goes to the left. Everything is balanced. In order to launch 1 ampere of current into the right-hand side of that dipole, I must subtract 1 ampere of current out of the left side. Action and reaction, balanced. Now, if I did something by throwing away the lower half of the dipole, and I still want to launch 1 ampere at 36 volts to the right-hand side of that dipole, I've got a problem. Where's the counterpoise? Where's the ground plane? Where's the point of reference? When the other half of the dipole was there, I could launch 1 ampere to the right by subtracting 1 ampere from the left. I could launch positive 36 volts to the left, but to the right, by simultaneously launching negative 36 volts to the left. When you have an unbalanced antenna, unless you've got the world's biggest ground plane to connect the shield of the coax to, you're trying to launch current into the antenna. The only place the current can come from now is the other outside. The center conductor is going to the antenna. The shield is going to something. If the something is in a great big chunk of copper, you're launching current back into the outside of the coax cable, and it's going to come roaring down into the shack. And whether you've got an antenna tuner there is only going to maximize the effect. It ain't going to minimize it. And the word ground, when it comes to an RF circuit, is a very relative word. The big joke we had at the factory that I worked at, which had an antenna department, is partially understanding manager would come in periodically and said, "You guys are not grounding that antenna. How do I know it's safe?" So in order to satisfy that guy, somebody one day brought in a great big flower pot filled up with dirt, had a piece of 6-gauge wire coming out of it, and he put a sign across the flower pot, "Good Earth Ground." And he would bring that flower pot over near the antenna, and he would have a clip lead going from the wire coming out of the flower pot to the antenna that was under test, a microwave antenna. Preposterous. Funny joke. The manager never caught on. He saw the fact that it was a good ground, and the earth was there to make it a good ground, the wire connected to it, and they told him the antenna was grounded. He went away happy, and everybody laughed under their breath. Okay, so an unbalanced antenna, a single-ended antenna, has a serious problem. Where do you subtract the current from while you're launching the current into the antenna? It's a classic problem. How do you get away from the problem? One solution is to take the brute force approach. Use balanced antennas, like dipoles. The only other approach is to create a great big sheet of copper somewhere near the feed point of the antenna where you launch the current into it. One way to do that would be to convert your 600-ohm, your 60-foot-long long wire into a L long wire. In other words, the bottom of the wire comes down to earth. In other words, you go up 20 feet and out 40 feet if you want it to be exactly 60 feet of wire, and the portion that comes down 20 feet, make it come straight to the ground and put a whole bunch of ground plane radials there. Well, it's a whole lot of work to put down those ground plane radials to establish the counterpoise. It's much easier to complete the other half of the antenna. feed it in the center. Balanced antennas fed properly with balancing devices do not have this problem. So once you understand that you can't launch RF current into something without subtracting the exact same amount of RF current from something else, a balanced dipole does that beautifully. And if you avoid a balanced dipole, you're going to have this problem. The only thing left to discuss is how much of it you're going to have. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, we've got a problem here because a 60-foot length of wire end set, you have a situation here. Basically, if you look at it this way, another way of looking at it, any end set wire that is a quarter wavelength long, or you know, an odd multiple of a quarter wavelength long, I guess can be considered what we would call a low peak speed antenna, and will have a high current, low voltage feed. On the other hand, when you get this thing on antenna and it becomes on the other band, starts becoming a half wavelength long or multiples of a half wave and an end set, I would assume you're going to look at more of a high impedance antenna and will have a high voltage, low current feed situation. I think this is basically what he's running into because, like you said, on 80 meters have no problem, but on 40, 20, 15 meters is where I get this problem. So this is basically what's happening, Dick, I assume, over.
You've got it, Mel. In the case of a person who wants to make a very simple antenna on his balcony of his fifth floor apartment building, he's got nothing but a railing there, so railing is a good enough counterpoise if and only if the antenna is a even number of quarter wavelengths long, multiples of a half wave. When you feed one end of a half wave dipole, your impedance is around 2,000 ohms. It takes very little current to do that. You're therefore sucking very little current out of the metal railing that you mount that antenna to, and it'll work, and you won't have much RF in the shack. Make that antenna a quarter wave long, where the input impedance is now 36 ohms, and for the same amount of power, you're launching a lot of current into the antenna. You're trying to subtract that amount of current out of the metal railing of your balcony, and it's going to get RF hot. So half-wave antennas, you can get away with these single-ended feeds. Anything but half-wave, you're going to run into a problem. The pure answer to it is to run symmetric antennas. I'm running into a very similar problem when it comes to one of my clients I work for as a consultant. He's got a small handheld product. He wants to put a UHF antenna into it, and I'm recommending that he use balanced antennas. If not, he's launching current with reference to the printed circuit board inside. The printed circuit board becomes hot if he's got an unbalanced antenna. And now, how the person holds the product in his hand is somewhat close to the printed circuit board, separated by the plastic case. He can end up with a hot circuit inside, RF-wise. That gives you some electromagnetic interference and compatibility grief. On top of that, as the person shifts his hand, he's shifting the tuning of the antenna. Whereas if you use a thoroughly balanced antenna and you don't launch any current into the printed circuit board, the whole system becomes a lot less sensitive to both of those problems. Balanced antennas are a beautiful solution, and if not, make sure that the antenna is electronically half-wavelength long at the feed point. Therefore, the current will be low, and you can get away with it. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Exactly. Very good. Very clever. This is K2KEY. Basically, what I would do in the case of this gentleman, in other words, on 80 meters, you find you have no problem with 60 feet of wire because it's a multiple of a quarter. Now, this will cover you with 10 meters you will have no problem getting this RF bite. Now, if you're going to operate 40 and 20 and 15 with this situation, you would want to make this odd quarter multiple. So what you do to the 60 feet, believe it or not, you'll just add, if you add a piece of wire on the end, about 20 feet, in other words, make it 80 feet long, and this will eliminate your problem for 40, 20, and 15, because you're getting away now from using that as a half-wave multiple, and you're converting it to quarter-wave multiples. You'll see, I think that's the simplest way to get out of this pick, over.
Yeah, well, we may have it backwards there, Mel, though. Quarter-wave multiples, you've got an open circuit at the far end, therefore you're going to see a short circuit at the input end. Quarter-wave multiples, odd number of quarter-wave multiples, low impedance. Even number of quarter-wave multiples, you see a high impedance if you're feeding it from one end. So, or another way of saying is multiples of half-wave. So either go balanced in the antennas, or if you really love unbalanced antennas, NZZ, make sure the wire is some even number of quarter-wave or some number of half-wave. Now the impedance is high, and you can get away with feeding one end without a huge ground plane. Back to you, Mel.
Basically, all right, we'll boil it down to saying that a quarter wave length will actually give you low impedance, and that means high current with low voltage. On the other hand, if we have half wave long, multiple half waves at the end, we'll have high impedance, and we'll have a high voltage and a low current speed, correct?
You got it. And it's basically the current you launch into the outside of the coax that comes into the shack. If at the point of feeding your antenna you can keep the current low, you will be pouring very little power into the outside shield of your coax, which roars its way down into the shack. Therefore, you won't have a hot microphone in the shack if you keep the current at the feed point of the antenna low. You got it. Back to you, Mel.
Okay. Very good. All right. I guess that's coming towards the end, Rio. Right now, we'll be losing the repeater in about 10 minutes. All right. So I think maybe we should get involved with one more takeover.
I really have to leave. Something I've got to do tomorrow. So I'm gonna start signing off. This was TechNet number 1162 of the series that began in September 1982. Excuse me, a little more than 25 years and a couple of months ago. Apparently, there's still some questions to be answered. And if that's true, and we stay healthy, Mel and I will be back next week. These 1940 guys, they're rugged. These guys that once attended Pratt Institute, they're rugged people. They keep coming back. So most likely, we'll be back next week. 73, you all, be kind to each other. And Mel, back to you, sir.
Okay, yeah, we are rugged. This is H2KBY. Okay, you say so, Dick. I'll take your word for it. All right, I'm just going to wish everybody a great Thanksgiving this week. Enjoy the meal. Don't overeat, and take care of your traveling. Be careful. There's going to be a lot of people out there, you know, traveling this week, and maybe a little bit rough going because they did predict we may have some rough weather. So, you know, I would like everybody to come back next week and join us again on the TechNet. Thank you very much, and I'll try, I could say we try to get to the emails and all. I have a batch for. I will try to answer some of them. The ones I can answer briefly on the keyboard, but bear with me. I'm a bit of a hunt tech, and have a little bit of trouble sometimes, you know, phrasing it so you can really understand it, because some of these problems are somewhat complex, as you can see. It can't be explained within, under 25 words. So with that, 73 is all, and we'll be seeing you hopefully next week. This is H2KBY.
And one last word here. I am amazed that Mel is volunteering to answer all of those emails, to act as a consultant to all these people. Don't take it personal if he can't get to you. He's only one human being. I try to avoid the problem by running away from it. I'm telling everybody, with rare exception, I will not answer emails. You call me on the phone, you talk to me on the air, I can talk to you at 150 words a minute if I get excited. That I'm willing to do. I'm a very slow typer by Mel standards, so I try not to do email answering unless it's a very rare occasion. So go easy with him. You're asking more than you should be when you're doing it. 73 you all, bye-bye for now.
Okay, ditto. Thank you very much, Dick. You put it really in the right word. 73 is all.